good. You're good. You're good. It's very funny.
Hey, Real Thing, Timothy here. If you're a regular listener to the show...
A fan, maybe?
Yeah, all right, ease up, Mike. If you like the show at all, stick around because we've got... should we just do this now?
I'm not waiting, man.
Okay, let's talk.
I'm too excited.
Let's tell everyone.
We need to tell people about this right now.
For our last episode of the season, we're going to do the show, The Real Thing, live.
Live, in front of other human beings. We got some details and we're not mucking around. Wednesday, November 30th at the Channel at the Arts Centre in Melbourne. We're going to be there. Also,
Thursday, the following day, we're going to be back up in Sydney on December 1st at 107 Projects, and that's in Redfern.
There'll be support acts, magic, scissors, paper, rock. It's a gig. We haven't exactly worked it out yet, but we can guarantee it's going to be heaps of fun.
These shows are being presented by our friends at Audiocraft. They help foster the Australian podcasting community.
Legends. Now, for more details about this thing, head to the Real Thing page on the RN website. More info, links to tickets and everything will be there. They're intimate rooms, so don't miss out.
Since we blew the big news at the start, do people have anything to stick around for?
No, there's more. There's more. We haven't announced the Mary Lunig original.
All right.
So
we'll do that at the end.
Okay, cool. But today's story, by the way, just a heads up, it deals with war and there's a bit of swearing too.
I have, and this will come as a great shock to a lot of people, but I have written other songs.
That's John Schumann, multi-songwriter.
Are you sick of talking about the song?
No. Well, yes and no. It's like a father with five kids, of whom he is proud in equal measure and loves in equal measure. But one of the kids plays AFL footy.
This is what it feels like to have a massive hit, so big it swallows anything else you've ever made.
And the only child that anybody outside the family wants to talk about is the AFL footy player. So you get a bit defensive sometimes of the other kids, or in my case, the other songs in my catalogue.
But John's song didn't just play AFL footy. It's credited with unifying a movement that changed the national conversation about Vietnam vets.
I was only 19.
On July 20, 1969, a couple of blokes were doing everything they could to step on the moon. Meanwhile, back on planet Earth, young Australian men were also concerned with what they were standing on. They were doing everything they could to avoid stepping on a mine.
Operation Muttingboro, you know, trees, saplings are only bloody, probably the highest be 30 metres. Heavily mined, we knew. Always on alert.
They were fighting in the Vietnam War.
I was carrying the radio. By the time I got the sixth set in Vietnam and Operation Muttingboro, I'd forgotten everything about the bloody thing. So I was learning on the job as we went. Now, being a SIGGY, I've got to be close to my platoon commander, just in case an instruction comes over and I've got to hand the handset to him.
Skipper said they should have a break.
Have a smoke over.
So they pull up, and that's when they found out.
Skip, message just come through, the Yanks have done it. He said, done what? I said, they land on the moon. Oh, stuff the Yanks. Spread another word around, okay, check for mines around you. And then he went back, put his foot over the pack. Next thing, bloody, boom. Ears were still ringing. Dust, noise, mine drill, mine drill, do your mine drill.
General, you ever see an end to the fighting here?
Oh, yes. Yes, very definitely.
When?
Just as soon as we can kill them all out here.
Still a long way to go before we hear the end of the controversy over the spraying of chemical defoliants in the Vietnam War.
Vietnam was not an easy war to fight. You had the best equipped army in the world taking on one of the most experienced. The Viet Cong were invisible most of the time. In the jungle, soldiers had to learn new ways of killing. And more importantly, new ways of coming out alive.
Vietnam was just a sort of a war in a far-off place that we didn't have very much to do with until Robert Caston got killed, and that sort of came home to us.
Robert Caston was a local guy, the older brother of a kid in John Schumann's class. John remembers seeing him in the playground.
You know, the parish went into deep, deep shock.
John had grown up with the war in the background, but now he was a bit older. The possibility of going became real, whether he liked it or not.
Conscription was very much in play in the 60s. Vietnam was on my horizon. I mean, it was a distinct possibility that I could get sent there. I'd already sort of worked out in my head, naive and idiotic as I was, that if my number was pulled out of the barrel, then I wasn't going to resist, I would go. I mean, I had no geopolitical conscience. I was just a kid at school playing basketball, thinking about music and girls.
John's number never came up. He wasn't conscripted. Instead, he went to study philosophy at Flinders Uni. Here, his attitude to war and lots of other things changed. He was also now in a band named after a tree, Red Gum. Very 70s. Mother says, son, we're gonna run. Just jump, pile on a dope bust, mum. Saying goodbye, then the drug squad come. In the name of the Lord, they punch him in the jaw. We're gonna run to now. Red Gum got together in 75, the same year the war in Vietnam ended.
Even though we hadn't had a hit single, you know, Red Gum was a pretty successful band, you know. It's just that it wasn't acknowledged by the music industry. Red Gum existed on the political continuum a fair way to the left.
But never, ever compare Red Gum to Midnight Oil.
Sort of...
If Midnight Oil...
Declaratively... Oh, no, go on.
Sorry.
Midnight. Look, let me tell you something about Midnight Oil. Let me tell you something about Midnight. When we were singing songs about the environment, Indigenous Australia, American imperialism and all that sort of stuff, Midnight Oil was singing songs about surfboard wax at the Royal Antler at Narrabeen.
Anyway, John had noticed some mates who'd returned from Vietnam who were struggling. He knew that that could have easily have been him. They'd copped it first in a war zone and now back at home. They weighed on his mind.
And they came home and they were, you know, fundamentally altered. As I sort of watched them try to reconstruct their lives, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. And I started to think about what it would be like to come back from a very unpopular war, a very divisive war, and not be welcome homed. There's a couple of blokes I knew who were battling the bottle. There was a lot of dysfunction, it seemed to me, unemployment, you know, a disengagement. I was thinking, you know, that I'd like to write a song about Australia's Vietnam veterans and our participation in that war. But
those cold chisel boys beat him to it. Let my heart to the Zappos round casing. And I sold my soul with my cigarettes to the black market man. I've had the Vietnam cold turkey. You know how it goes.
Don Walker wrote Kaysan. And I remember when Kaysan came out, which I thought, you know, then was an absolutely sensational song. And I thought, oh, well, that's it, you know, Don's done it. And I don't know. I don't know what made me sort of put Kaysan to one side and write my own. I don't know.
For John to write this song, he'd have to find a way in. He describes vets in those days as a closed circle. Now, Red Gum's a folk band and John's a storyteller. Writing fictional stuff just wasn't his bag. He'd have to find a veteran who'd trust him enough to share their story. It'd require a bit of luck.
I know just coming back, coming into Adelaide and the numbers of people around you, the difference, the noise, etc. And yeah, if something does go bang, you do half drop to the ground because that's what you've been trained to do.
This is Mick Storen. Mick served in Vietnam in the 6th Battalion.
It becomes instinctive, and a lot of it doesn't go out of your system. I still make my bed the same way I did in the Army. I mean, that's the only way you can do it.
All right, we've got to do it.
The bed itself is required to be taut so that the inspecting officer can come and flick a 20-cent piece on it, which must bounce. If it doesn't bounce, you're in trouble.
You got 20 cents? I don't.
Jeez.
Bounces. Two bounces. Still got it. Mick and John Schumann's paths would cross when John started dating a girl called Denise, or Denny. One night, she decided she'd put their relationship on the line.
She brought her family along to watch Redgum do an acoustic performance at the Oxford Theatre in Unley.
So Denise invites me along to one of, you know, John's concerts at the Unley Town Hall.
Mick was Denny's older brother.
I remember being told that Mick had been to Vietnam, that he'd been involved in a pretty awful mine incident, that he was wounded. I also knew that he didn't talk about it to his family.
And he gives a rousing sort of performance. And
did you like it?
Yeah, of course I did. It was really, you know, it was good stuff.
Phew. John had passed the Is My Boyfriend's Band Any Good test. So naturally, they all went out for a couple of beers.
I got to meet John afterwards.
And I was probably flying on adrenaline or something. And I just remember plucking up my courage and asking if he would talk to me about what happened in Vietnam.
He thought he wanted to do a song.
Anyway, to my surprise, he said that he would.
I guess there's a little bit of trust there that if you're dating his sister, that you must be an all right bloke.
Well, yeah, I think he thought I was okay.
As okay as any potential brother-in-law might feel. So Mick agreed to the chat.
He did put some conditions on the conversation.
Remember, Mick was about to do something very personal. Talking about Vietnam was tough in any context.
I wasn't to disparage his mates. Well, that was the last thing I wanted to do. And he also said that, you know, if we did have the conversation and I did write a song, that I would play it to him first. And if he didn't approve of it, then the song would not see the light of day.
If the song was no good, that'd be it. It just wouldn't go anywhere. I think I might have made a bit of a proviso that, you know, his song didn't turn out anything like the Green Beret or something like that.
A couple of months later, they got together.
He kept his word. He came up to Denny's place.
You know, come up to Cherry Gardens and
Denny, being the organised person that she is, set up a ghetto blaster with a stack of cassettes.
And so we have a few beers. He wants to get me lubricated.
Drink some beer and...
Anyway, I basically start off from what it was like when I joined the army, etc., and all the way through the training and all the rest of it.
As we talked, I would put the cassettes in and press the red button.
It kept me talking and talking. Ended up with about 3.5 hours of tape.
There were quite a few cassettes at the end of the night. It was done in a very haphazard kind of way. I was keen to get the detail, you know, the smells and the sights and the sound and what it felt like. Yeah, I don't know, just little things that helped me sort of construct a detailed picture of what it was like to be a soldier in Vietnam at that time.
Yeah, I wasn't quite paralytic. I was able to drive home, but I probably shouldn't have.
John carried those cassettes around with him on tour for the next 6 months.
We had some of the very first Walkman. They were like bricks, these things. I listened to these cassettes about this conversation I had with Mick. I didn't know what I was going to do with them. Honestly, I just listened to the conversations and looked out the window as we, you know, drove up and down the east coast of Australia in a Mitsubishi Star wagon.
Second operation, we went down into the light green because of the forested, scrubby, sandy sort of area. We unfortunately had a mine incident.
I Was Only 19 is written in the first person, and even though the name Frankie appears, the story was told by Mick. Mick is the guy who was only 19. Over the decades, for several reasons, Mick refused to talk publicly about his role in the song. It's only recently that he's been open to the idea of doing a handful of interviews.
My dad was a pharmacist. We went very, very few holidays. So cadet camps was a great way of being involved in something other than just family as well.
He was thinking about a career in the army, so he volunteered for the National Service. At the time, they were running conscription. But he got knocked back.
My chief fault was at afternoon tea during the interview process. Somebody brought up the rock fishing. Then I asked one of the psychological officers whether, in fact, he had caught many good rocks lately. So that probably wasn't a wise thing to do.
Oh, Mick, that's a shocker, mate. So he goes to the army and gets accepted. He gets sent to recruit training at Pakapunyal, but you probably already knew that.
One of the coldest places in Victoria, which is where they seem to set up most army training bases.
8 weeks in, and an announcement was made.
The 6th Battalion, which was currently up in Townsville, was asking for volunteers to do core training with them. So instead of going to another nasty place like Singleton and New South Wales, you could go to sunny Queensland. So
up north, the weather would be heaps better, but you were definitely going to be going to war. But Mick was up for it.
So I thought that would be the shot to do, would be to get straight into a battalion, train with them, and then go overseas.
He got lucky, drew the right card, and was sent. Almost exactly 1 year after he'd started training, he was boarding HMAS Sydney to fight in Vietnam. He said goodbye to his folks.
Oh, I think they were both probably fairly worried. There were big casualties. We did get flown home for pre-embarkation leave.
What did you do in that week? What do you do?
Oh, well, you went and saw your girlfriend, of course. I know I went over and saw my friends over on the West Coast where I'd worked.
What was it like? Was it emotional?
Friends, yeah. I suppose it was fairly emotional. But by that stage of the game, and this was it. This was what you'd been training for. You took it matter-of-factly. This was going to be the business end.
5 days after setting sail, they landed, and their senses were overwhelmed.
You arrived at the port of Vung Tau. It's all its smells and its heat, helicopters up to Nui Dap. Nui Dap base itself was in the middle of a rubber plantation, six-man tents basically with four people in them. This is all new, apart from your training, etc. and the rest of it. You're all agog. There's the heat, the dust. These are the conditions you're going to have to live in and survive in.
From there, he went on 4 or 5 week operations into the jungle.
What were often the objectives of the operations? Was it about land?
A lot of it would be search and destroy, going into the jungles, trying to search out the enemy, finding their bunker systems, trying to initiate contact, trying to kill them.
It's G, and then think, oh, where am I going to go there? Well, I'll go to D, and that's interesting.
Back in Camp Red Gum, John Schumann had no idea how he was ever going to turn these cassette tapes of mixed war stories into a song.
For months.
He was living in Melbourne at the time, and one night after a gig in Gippsland.
I used to hate Gippsland. There were never any gigs at Gippsland that I liked.
Good one, Gippsland.
And then can you tell me, doctor?
He woke up the next morning, walked into his backyard in North Carlton.
And I had a cup of coffee and my guitar and a pad and a biro and a packet of smokes. And
what's this rash that comes and goes? Can you tell me what it, where am I going to go here? I'll go back to the A.
Sat down and wrote I Was Only 19.
That's it. That's how it happened.
God help me, I was only 19. Back to the D and there I was.
The song that painted the emotional fallout from a landmine came to John almost fully formed in one hit.
It's as simple and as complicated as that. You know, bleh, there it is.
So he had the song, but he still had to get the okay from Mick. Were you worried about getting that permission, and how did that go down?
No, I thought it was pretty good. You know, I was pretty happy.
About 3 months later.
It was at a family function.
We're having tea at my mum's place at Marino.
I think it was in Blair, and he thinks it was at Seacombe Heights, but it doesn't matter.
The place really doesn't matter.
Comes in, says, I've got the song. I said, oh, very good. It said, I'll play it. So we go up to a bedroom at Mum's place.
Played him the song.
Sits down and plays it.
And I remember that he looked at me, you know, he didn't say anything.
Mum and Dad and Denny saw the passing out parade at Puckapunyal. It was a long march from cadets. The 6th Battalion was the next to tour, and it was me who drew the card. We did Canungra. Shoal water before we left.
He just stared at me, and I'm pretty sure Denny and I were engaged. I can't remember, but I'm thinking, you know, this is the guy who's going to be my brother-in-law, and I've really, you know, really trodden in it here.
The hairs had gone up at the back of my neck, but I was still trying to work out, is this good? Is this bad?
And I remember having to ask him several times whether
well,
I could introduce it to the Red Gum repertoire.
is it any good? And I said, yeah. It was just incredible, you know. I had anticipated that he was going to do some generic some generic song. Not my personal history.
No surprises. The song absolutely floors Mick. It was confronting, but he knew it was special. That was obvious. There were just a couple of details that weren't 100% true. John had taken artistic license with a few things to make it work. For example,
got some pieces in my back, meaning the shrapnel, that I didn't even feel.
Of course he felt it.
It wasn't a hurtful or painful experience. It was just a hot little zap, slight rush of blood, and then it congealed.
It was mostly minor stuff, like the line, he was going home in June. Not the case at all, but it rhymed with moon, so, you know. There was one problem, though, that Mick felt very strongly about, and that was who kicked the mine.
He had the name Tommy in it.
Originally, Tommy, a name John had just made up, kicked the mine.
Ah, well, the name Tommy, to me, was a bit weak. Tommy's from the First World War or whatever, and I hadn't known anybody named Tommy in my experience in the army.
And I said, well, give me a name.
Peter Hines, the word, you know, Peter fits in beautifully because the whole thing rhymes.
And it was Skipper Peter Hines who'd shot on the mine.
Skip, message just come through, the Yanks have done it. Next thing, bloody
contact! Boom.
Mick was very keen to keep Skipper Hines out of it. We didn't want to stir up Skipper Hines' family. All the boys, you know, subsequently in that incident, they are very, very reverential and respectful of the memory of both Skipper Hines and John Needs, who was the corporal, both of whom who were killed in that mine incident.
He was married and he had a child, and if the song does go somewhere, do we want that as a painful reminder?
So, no to Tommy, no to Peter, Mick thought through some of his mates in his platoon.
See, Frank Hunt was badly wounded in that particular mine incident. I was just running through a couple of names and had to be short. Frank said, Frank. And he said, Frankie kicked the mine. And oh, I just went, boah, that fits. But I said, you have to see Frank Hunt.
I didn't really understand then exactly why, but, you know, because for me, you know, names were immaterial. It was the story. But it was important to Mick.
No, I didn't even know what the war was about, really.
Frank Hunt grew up in the Mallee in northwest Victoria. Now, there's two things you got to know about the Mallee. One, the mice.
You couldn't go away for a week with a mice plague in the Mallee.
The second thing is,
in the Mallee, we were brought up to protect women. You never heard anyone say a bad word about someone's mum. Otherwise, we were blue.
Frank grew up in farming. In 1967, there was a drought.
It was awful. Cutting our sheep's throat, we were.
He wanted to get out.
So I made my mind up I was going to join the army.
A fortnight before he left for Vietnam, he got engaged.
How long had you been courting?
Ah, 3.5 months.
Oh, right. Right.
Love at first sight. Probably a bit of lust thrown in. Anyway, she said to me, I've got something for you, Frank. It's a St. Christopher medal. Oh, I said, oh, I love it. Thank you very much. I'll put it with my dog tags.
Frank's a Catholic, and St. Christopher's the patron saint of travelling. As the forward scout for his platoon, he thought Chris might come in handy. During one of their jungle operations, Frank was in charge of the radio.
Operation Muttingboro, and next thing, bloody boom. Dust, noise, mind drill. Do your mind drill. Sunray 3 alpha, kilo wind cover, alpha, kill the action, identify the alpha, we see yellow, sunray, we see green, three, roger. Alpha.
It's a very sad twist that mine had been made by Australians. The enemy had learnt how to pick them up, transport and relay them without blowing them up. They put them in areas Australians were likely to pass. Skip was dead. Next in command was a close friend of Frank's, Johnny Needs.
First thing I did was actually put my hands down my trousers to find if I still had my equipment down there, which I was very relieved to find, but I still didn't know. I thought, holy hell. Anyway, I was hit through the scrotum, in fact. I now know how sheep feel when I was marking lambs. The first probably 90 seconds, didn't feel much pain at all. And then I started plugging holes with muddy paste. I had holes everywhere, my face, my chest, my arms, my shoulders.
Frank says Needsy saved his life.
Needsy said to me, Frank, he said, I've got to get you out of here, mate. He said, I've got to get you out. He said, you've done a great job. I remember him saying that, you've done a great job, mate. You really held it together. He said, because I've got to get you dusted off first. He said, you're in a bad, real bad way, mate, but hang in there, keep fighting. But he threw me over his shoulder, and laid me into the stretcher. I still bear the scar just in here, where a piece of shrapnel hit the St. Christopher medal, embedded the St. Christopher medal into my chest. Really good piece of the heart. So St. Christopher saved me.
They winched him up into a chopper. While Frank was being taken away, another mine went off. Needsy was killed instantly. It was a worst-case scenario for these soldiers. It's a miracle that Frank survived.
I can still feel the pain as that bloody thing just went round and round in circles. And I was even hitting branches off the trees. Some of the trees were still there. I was hitting branches. Pieces of metal and my bones were grating together. All my fractures were grating together. And the shrapnel was appeared to be going in deeper and deeper as this thing got faster and faster, and then hit another bloody branch. And then he got me inside this African-American. Medevac, obviously a nurse, kept whacking me across the face. Wake up, you son of a bitch, wake up. I woke up and said, don't you call my mother my dog. And I went to punch him. He just laughed. Well, the Yanks have done it. He'd done his job, he kept me alive.
Not long after Mick had given his blessing, John Schumann was playing a gig near Bega, where Frank now lived.
I tracked him down and introduced myself and played him the song.
November 1982, John Schumann from Red Gum. Have you heard of a band called Red Gum? I said, no, I haven't. And he said, yeah, can you come down to Tartha tonight? I said, no, I can't. I've got a legacy meeting on.
I have to say, Frank was not all that keen on opening the door to a long-haired left-wing pinko. He opened the door to me on the basis of, you know, Mick's recommendation.
Mick's drawings, mate. And I said, oh, if you made it, Mick, you must be all right.
I'm pretty sure I went to Frankie's house in Bega.
So I went down, went to his, still remember the room, room 8, Surfside Motel.
Honestly, the place really doesn't matter.
Anyway, I played him this song.
Played and sang. I asked him to do it again.
And then he wanted to hear it again and again until I begged him to allow me to play it into a cassette so I could stop playing it. But he was pretty knocked out.
Obviously, they'd had some very deep and meaningful conversations. Otherwise, he wouldn't have come out with a ripper of a song like that. And then he was playing the song, and Frankie kicked the mine. And I thought, oh, hang on. I said, is that me you're talking about? Yeah.
Frank helped lots of veterans after coming back, but he wasn't in contact with anyone from his platoon.
I still don't know who'd stood on the mine, mate. I haven't spoken to anyone about it. I have not spoken to anyone about it.
But even to this day, after reconnecting with lots of the guys who tell him otherwise, he won't accept if he did or didn't step on the mine.
But by going along with it, Mike, and saying, well, I still don't know who did, however, I allowed my name to protect the innocent, and I've allowed my name to be used because I believe it's going to help the veteran and his family.
And that's why he said yes. He agreed that it wouldn't be right to use Skip's name. Also, he genuinely believed that the song could help other vets.
After working for Veterans Help Home since for over a decade, I knew this song could reach out to them. This could be a catalyst for a lot of veterans to go and get help. And that's what happened, exactly what happened. So-and-so would ring off it of other battalions. So-and-so would rank so-and-so and, did you hear that song? But you
wouldn't let your mates. After that, I said to John, when things really started to gather momentum, that I didn't want to be involved in any publicity or anything for the song because it was too personal. For me, it was just too personal. Those first few years of hearing the song, it would have an effect on me. And that was where Frank was really good. Frank stepped into the void there. And being a boy from the Mallee, he was a bit of a raconteur. Never slow with a word.
And when John said, look, I need someone there, mate, to support me. I can get up there and speak, but it's not going to have the same power as a veteran getting up there and speaking. And you were there that day. You're Frankie.
Frank was terrific. Frank understood that here was an opportunity to represent Vietnam veterans and all their trials and tribulations to the rest of Australia.
But then I would get there and I would extend that to everyone that went to Vietnam as Frankie. Whilst it did happen to me, yes, and I was badly wounded, yes, and I did spend 19 and a half months in hospital, yes. I did have the last rites 5 times, yes. I did have 30-odd operations in that time, yes. The song, everyone is Frankie.
It's essentially McStoran's story, but it's every Vietnam veteran's story.
And can you tell me, doctor, why I still can't get to sleep?
John and Hugh McDonald from Red Gum decided to give all royalties from the single to the Vietnam Veterans Association.
The band had had a meeting and they decided they didn't want to record I Was Only 19.
It was their decision because they were the only ones who played on it. Band politics, including the fact their last album hadn't done so well and the future was looking pretty dire, almost skittled the song once more. When it did finally get out there, its impact was immediate. It went to number one while John wasn't even in the country. He was on his honeymoon with Denny.
We are a nation of storytellers and we are fundamentally fair and decent as a nation. You know, that story made us stop in our tracks and go, oh, hang on a tick, you know, right, Vietnam veterans. We didn't really do the right thing by those boys and we better sort of, you know, fix that up. And I think, you know, we started to fix it up. You know, particularly with the Welcome Home Parade in 1987.
Well, I think a lot of us had tears yesterday and today. It's just something that we can't explain.
Oh, lovely! Last time that happened, I got married.
The parade took place 4 years after I Was Only 19 was released. The push behind this event and the recognition was undoubtedly linked to the song.
Imagine going to war and coming back in the middle of the night and being told to, you know, don't tell anybody you've been to Vietnam, you know, grow your hair, slip back into Australian society, just don't discuss it.
They had paint thrown over them, they were abused.
It would have been horrible, you know. 1973, the war ended, and 1987, they were able to march down the streets of Sydney and be welcomed home genuinely by the rest of their country that they served honourably.
I can still see Frankie drinking tinnies in the Grand Hotel on a 36-hour rig leave in Bung Tau.
The day after the parade, John played Only 19 in the Domain. Video footage shows Frank in a wheelchair next to John, his kids are by his side, and friends are jumping the barrier to get on stage to give him a hug.
The Anzac legends didn't mention Martin Blood's tears.
I was only 19.
In 2005, The Herd covered it for Like a Virgin, and a new generation learnt the story.
Very few Australian songwriters get to write anything like this had the lasting effect of I Was Only 19. But it's a great responsibility. You know, in all the important ways, it's owned by the people about whom I wrote it. So I have to be very careful and guard its integrity. It's a hymn, and, you know, you don't fuck around with a hymn.
I was only 19.
I Was Only 19 is one of APRA's top 30 Australian songs. We hope you've been enjoying Australian Music Month across the ABC.
Now, before we go, if you've been following this podcast, you'll know we've been running a little competition. And the prize is priceless because it's a Mary Lunig original artwork.
Now, when Mary sent the artwork up to us, she left a little note in there. And the note said she didn't think we should actually give it away. She thought we should make a copy and give that away. Even though Mary's not a fan of copies, it was very confusing.
She wanted us to keep the artwork.
Because it was of us.
Yeah.
But we want you to have it.
That's right. We said no way. We're giving it to you.
No way, Mary.
I almost said giving it to the fans then. Giving it to the listeners are part of this thing who have come along for the ride with us to say thank you. The winner, Timothy, drum roll, please. Okay, so I have the winner's number. Pull it up here and we're going to give it a ring.
I hope she's excited, otherwise this is going to be awkward.
We will see. Okay, here we go. It's ringing.
Hello.
Hi, Claire.
Hi, yeah.
Yeah, Claire, it's Mike here from The Real Thing. How are you going?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks. Claire, well, it's I got Timothy here with me, actually.
Hello, Claire.
Hi, how are you going?
The reason we're ringing
so
you.
So weird.
sorry. We've never done this before.
That's all right.
Claire, you have won the Mary Lunig original artwork.
Oh, really? That's amazing.
Congratulations.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you for entering.
Oh, wow.
Have you seen the artwork yet?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Okay.
This might be a bit of a shock.
Wow. I can't believe it.
We're just glad you're excited. Oh, wow. You may become less excited when you see that the artwork involves our faces, but nonetheless, enjoy. Congratulations.
Okay. Thank you so much. You've made my day.
That's great. Where are you going to put it?
I'll put it up in my studio.
Oh, okay. What do you do?
So I create clothing and I do wooden signboards and all sorts of bits and pieces. So it's a bit of a mess, but fairly creative. So it's,
Great. Okay. Fantastic. Claire McWilliam from Hanwood in the Riverina, New South Wales. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks, Claire.
Not a worry. Thank you.
Catch you later. For everyone else who entered, thank you again. Thanks for being part of it. We have some limited edition stickers coming your way. Please bear with us. We will get you the stickers, I promise.
It may take a little while. We're working hard, we promise.
I'm Mike Williams.
I'm Timothy Nicastri.
And I'm Ramona Kermy, series producer of Classic Flow, Classic 2's brand new podcast. It's blissful yoga paired with beautiful classical music. And that's the end of episode 8 of The Real Thing.